The day after the House approved two articles of impeachment against President Trump, the next step is unclear. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell today said House Speaker Nancy Pelosi failed to meet her own standard for impeachment.
And it was made even more clear last night when Speaker Pelosi suggested that House Democrats may be too afraid to even transmit their shoddy work product to the Senate. Mr. President, it looks like the prosecutors are getting cold feet.
McConnell is referring to Speaker Nancy Pelosi's comment that she could delay sending the articles of impeachment onto the Senate for a trial. A reporter asked her about that today.
Last night you suggested you needed to see a fair process in the Senate before submitting it over.
A fair process, but we'll see what they have, and we'll be ready for whatever it is.
Is that the requirement? You need to see a fair process before submitting over?
We would hope there would be a fair process.
Let's bring in Congressman Harley Ruda, Democrat of California. He voted for both articles of impeachment. Congressman, welcome.
Glad to be on the show. Thank you.
Well, and what do you think about the idea of Democrats delaying giving the articles to the Senate? Do you think that more information would come forward, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the first I heard of that was just yesterday, and I recognize the Speaker's desire, as well as the Democratic Caucus's leadership desire, to make sure that we understand how the trial process will take place in the Senate. And so to have more information before submitting the articles of impeachment certainly has some validity. But I think to some degree this is being blown out of proportion. I don't anticipate the articles being held up for any significant period of time before they're submitted to the Senate for consideration.
Do you still expect, as many have for a long time, that a trial would happen in the Senate in the month of January?
I would imagine that is still the timeline that most people are looking to see occur, but certainly there are still some things that need to take place before we have a clear understanding as to what that schedule will be.
When it comes to a fair trial in the Senate, do you think that that means that people like Mick Mulvaney and John Bolton would testify, would be called as witnesses in a Senate trial?
Well, I think if Mitch McConnell and the Senate Republican leadership is serious about having a impartial trial to consider the articles of impeachment, yes, Bolton and Mulvaney should be there. So should Pompeo, as well as others that have defied the subpoenas rightfully offered by the House in its investigation of the Ukrainian matter.
How do you respond to the Republican argument here, which is, well, if you need to hear from these people, then shouldn't you have just waited to vote on the articles of impeachment in the House until you took the process through the courts, the subpoenas that have been issued, and got testimony from those witnesses in the House and then send it to the Senate?
You know, only Republicans could put forth an argument that says you didn't have all the testimony you needed while simultaneously defending the president from blocking that testimony from occurring. It is crazy to suggest that is how this should operate. If the president truly believed he has done nothing wrong and that these individuals would provide evidence and testimony showing that he has done nothing wrong, why in the world would he prevent them from testifying? We know why he's preventing them from testifying, because when they do testify, it is not going to help the president's case. In fact, it is just the opposite. And if that's not the case, then again, what is the logic from preventing them from testifying?
You represent a district in Orange County that was held by a Republican before you. Did you have any qualms about voting for articles of impeachment? Do you think you're going to face any blowback from voters there?
You know, I don't know if I'll face blowback or not. Here's what I do know. Unlike my Republican colleagues across the aisle who voted lockstep to support a crook in the White House, I will tell you that if this was a Democratic president who had done that, I would have voted for articles of impeachment. This is not a question of which party is in office, which party controls the White House. This is as simple as right and wrong regarding the oath we took to protect and uphold the Constitution of the United States. And, you know, they can argue all they want that the procedure was not what they wanted to see, or that additional witnesses being prevented by the president from testifying should have testified, but they cannot deny the fact that the president violated the law. And you saw that repeatedly yesterday, the failure for them to be able to argue the facts. And what was also interesting to see yesterday was those that would argue that there was no evidence here. It reminds me of the old Russian adage that if you tell a lie enough times, it becomes a truth. And apparently many people on the Republican side believe if you tell the lie enough, it does become the truth.
That is Congressman Harley Ruda, Democrat of California. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
The top seven candidates vying for the Democratic nomination for president face off tonight here in Los Angeles for the party's sixth debate this year. California plays a particularly important role this presidential election season, as its primary will happen in March, 3 months earlier than it was last time. Joining me here in studio to talk more about all of this is NPR's Scott Detrow. Welcome, Scott.
Hey there.
Okay, so this is the smallest debate stage yet, as we said. Let's go through the names. Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Andrew Yang, and Tom Steyer. In national polls, we see that Biden is leading with Sanders in second, followed by Warren and Buttigieg, although Buttigieg is leading in Iowa. Who do you think actually will be the bigger target tonight, Biden or Buttigieg?
I think it's Buttigieg, and I will put a clarifier here that I made this prediction last time, and
yeah,
it didn't happen, and everybody basically laid off Pete Buttigieg. But for the last 2 months, we have seen Pete Buttigieg steadily rise in his profile, in his polling numbers. We have seen him start to make direct attacks at Elizabeth Warren in particular. The two of them have really gone back and forth over policy, over transparency, over a bunch of things over the last few weeks. And he is now, like you mentioned, leading the polls in Iowa, high up there in New Hampshire as well. And I think the days of the rest of the debate stage ignoring Pete Buttigieg and saying, oh, isn't this a nice guy? You know, yeah. I think those days are over. And I would expect Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren in particular to maybe have a bit more high profile critiques of Buttigieg tonight.
Let's talk about something else. This is the first debate since Senator Kamala Harris left the race earlier this month. And we are in her home state, which means that gaining favor here is really up for grabs. Sanders seems to be leading, according to some polls, followed by Warren. In what ways do you think the candidates are going to be pitching to California voters tonight?
Yeah, California is the biggest prize on the Super Tuesday list of states on March 3rd. A ton of states across the country are going, but California will be the biggest prize, the most delegates up for stake. We had seen California moved its primary from June to March,
yep,
and we expected a lot more attention to go to California. It hasn't up until this point been as much attention as California expected to get, but I think that's starting to change now. Now, because there was so much focus on Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina in
yep
particular. But over the next few days, there's going to be a lot of campaign events here in California. Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez this weekend holding a big rally in Venice Beach. And I think going forward, especially once Iowa and New Hampshire have come and gone, you're going to see a lot of focus on California in particular. I think you have to look at Buttigieg and Sanders and Warren as the campaigns who will have the financial resources to compete in California because it's so expensive. It's almost all about airing ads in those big markets.
Yep.
And the fact that Joe Biden hasn't raised as much money as some of those other candidates, I think that this could be a place where they see the limitations of the money they've raised.
Let's talk a little bit more about what we'll see on stage as well. Andrew Yang will be the only non-white candidate. Do you think that he will make this a point tonight?
I'm not sure. I think he might. His campaign did keep mentioning it. That, hey, we're still here, too, when there was so much conversation after Kamala Harris dropped out of the race about the fact that this could be an all-white debate stage this evening. That was before he had gotten that final poll that he needed to qualify for
yep
the debate stage. He has now. His campaign has really gotten a lot more attention over the last couple months, and he has gone from being the kind of quirky candidate that people like talking about universal basic income and being a one issue candidate to running a much broader campaign,
yeah,
much more of a traditional looking campaign that's been getting a lot of attention and big crowds.
Yeah. You talked about Buttigieg up top, but he is still struggling to win over black voters. He's polling in the single digits in South Carolina. Has his campaign changed its strategy at all in response to all of this?
They've tried. They've been doing a lot more events in South Carolina, trying to have like round tables with you know African Americans in a bunch of places there, having running ads to this effect, really trying to issue more policy and be more in listening mode is a way that they talk about it. But it hasn't really seemed to work. He hasn't really, his numbers haven't moved. It's either 0% or 1% in a lot of polls. Mm-hmm. A point that they've made is that, look, Joe Biden has the overwhelming support of African-American voters, and there's a huge gap between him and everybody else. So their argument is, we're not the only campaign facing this problem, but certainly... Certainly to push back on that, he has gotten so much support in so many other corners of the Democratic electorate. It's very notable that the numbers haven't moved.
With the few seconds I have left with you, let's talk about the folks who aren't on the stage and how they will get the support of voters. We're talking about New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, as well as some other folks, Julian Castro and Senator Cory Booker. What will these candidates have to do to reach voters before the next debate?
Well, Bloomberg will spend tens of millions of dollars to be on their televisions. Cory Booker and Julian Castro are continuing to campaign in those early states. Booker's launching a bus tour today in Iowa.
That's NPR Scott Detrow. Listen to your NPR station tonight for coverage of the debate. Thank you so much, Scott, for taking the time.
Good to be here.
The immigrants are here to stay to help build America. Oy, 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 oy. The immigrants ain't going nowhere.
That's the song The Immigrants, a collaboration between singer-songwriter Gabby Moreno and producer Van Dyke Parks. The two decided to rework this 1998 track written by songwriter David Rutter as part of Moreno's new album, Spangled. When the two decided on this song, they had no idea just how relevant the lyrics would be at this moment. Gabby Moreno joins us here in studio to talk more about The Immigrants, her album, and her larger mission to use music as a bridge between the Northern and Southern American hemispheres. Gabby, welcome.
Thank you so much, Tanya. So lovely to be here.
So David Rutter's song, The Immigrants, as I mentioned, it was first recorded in 1998 after New York police officers attacked Haitian immigrant Abner Louima in Brooklyn back in 1997.
So much trouble in the home of the brave and the land of the NYPD. Am I an immigrant or am I a new slave made for old brutality?
You and Van Dyke changed some of the lyrics to reflect some of what's happening today and the immigrant experience. Tell me more about the updated version. What's different?
Well, the beginning of the song, you hear so much trouble in the home of the brave and the land of the NYPD. We wanted to reflect more what's happening in all of the United States. So we changed it to the land of the free. And then, you know, just make it be about everything that's happening with the immigrant issue in the United States.
Like a punta rock and the salsa samba, a highlight banda merengue. Así que dime tú. In other words, yeah. This is a different kind of apple now. New York City, or like an orange. I love LA. What a delight, right? And you say, yeah. But a little spicy.
What is it about the message that resonates so deeply with you?
I came to this country almost 2 decades ago from Guatemala.
We should say you're a rock star in Guatemala, by the way. People don't know. You're a big deal.
I wouldn't say rock star, but I have been making music for a very long time, and I started when I was very young in Guatemala. And it was an amazing opportunity to come here and explore other possibilities in music. So I feel so lucky and blessed to have that opportunity to be here. But at the same time, I see other people that are coming here under just dire circumstances. And I can't help, of course, but to feel empathy. And I want to be able to help more. But I know that all I have for now is my music and my art, and that's still a very powerful weapon. So I'm so fortunate to be able to send out a message through music.
Yeah, and I want to talk more about those messages and the fusion of different sounds from Latin America, from many different places in Latin America. One reviewer said the 10 songs center around, quote, the promises, hopes, and challenges facing both border communities and the American experiment at large. It is precisely in the moment. Let's take a listen to one of those songs, Across the Borderline.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline.
The first lyric, quote, I've been told there's a place where every street is paved with gold, and it's across the borderline. I heard that and I sort of smiled. I thought it was a narrative that I've heard before, and it's such a great one. But then the follow-up lyric goes on to say, when it's time to take your turn, remember that you could lose more than you ever hoped to find.
It's heartbreaking. It's just, it's such a sad song. You know, I want to sing songs of hope and love, but I think it's also important to paint the reality and the very sad reality that a lot of these people are living, where they want to come here thinking that, you know, they want to pursue their American dream. And yet, as soon as they cross that border, it's just a completely different story. And it's a very sad song.
You mentioned that you came to L.A. 18 years ago from Guatemala. And I've heard you say in the past that you felt that your feet are like in two different places.
Yeah.
Explain what you mean by feeling like you're of two worlds.
I still feel 100% Guatemalan, even though I've been living here for almost 2 decades. My whole family is in Guatemala. I came here solely because of my love for music. And I am so, so fortunate to be doing what I love. So, yes, I do feel like I'm straddling the fence between those two worlds, being immersed in this clash of cultures, you know, from Latin America and from the U.S. And that is reflected in my music as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I sing in Spanish and in English. Since the very first record, I've been doing this because this is my essence. This is what makes me who I am.
As I mentioned, you are a rock star in Guatemala, even though that makes you blush. Part of your mission, though, in being here is you want to bring Latin American music to a North American audience in a way that is more of a bridge and not a wall. Explain more about what you mean.
You know, I feel like the perfect example is something that I've been doing for the past couple of years. I've been lucky to be a part of a wonderful show called Live From Here with Chris Thiele.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really amazing because here's a show that is, I would say the audience is mostly, you know, white America.
Yeah.
And the genres that you hear are mostly bluegrass and country and Americana. But now I can bring my music to that equation. I can bring Latin music and mix it with bluegrass and with, you know, more of the country styles and folk styles.
Is there a song that embodies that that you can think of?
Yes. Actually, in my last album, Ilusión, I have a couple of songs. One is called Fronteras, which is, again, another song that is dedicated to immigrants and a song of hope, but that has a bluegrass feel to it.
Ay. Un camino que nos trajo hasta aquí no conoce las fronteras, esta pasión dentro de mí es anhelo el que me empuja cada nuevo amanecer con mis temores, ilusiones y los restos del ayer.
I love doing that. That's what I mean by by bridging those two worlds.
Yeah. Why was it important to record The Immigrants now?
Oh God, well, I just want to, it's something that I've been doing for a long time. I've been writing and singing about, you know, about immigrants, about celebrating diversity. And I want people to know that we are really doing a wonderful thing here. We've been here for, you know, forever, building this country. You know, immigrants are hard workers. And I just want people to, you know, have more love and empathy for all of us.
And understand that they're part of the tapestry of what makes this country this country.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people are forgetting that nowadays.
Hmm. That's singer-songwriter Gabby Moreno. Gabby, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Is there a particular song on this album that you'd love for us to go out on?
Oh, Alma Llanera. That was the first song that we recorded for this album. And actually the first song that was thought for this project. I remember I sent it to Van Dyke, and a couple days later I got the arrangement. This song is from Venezuela. It's like the second national anthem of Venezuela.
Oh, really?
Yes, and it's a gorgeous, gorgeous song, and I am so happy. It's one of my favorite songs from the album, and a love song to Venezuela.
Yo nací en una ribera, nací en una ribera de la Arauca vibrador. Soy hermano de la espuma, de las garzas, de las rosas. Soy hermano de la espuma, de las garzas, de las rosas.
De las garzas, de las rosas.
Soy y del sol.
Gabby Moreno's latest album is Spangle. To find out more about her collaboration with producer Van Dyke Parks on the song Across the Borderland, go to hereandnow.org.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world, and when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please, make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
Baseball has come up on the presidential campaign trail. That's because Major League Baseball wants to basically eliminate more than 40 minor league teams. Senator Bernie Sanders took a swing at that plan in a recent campaign stop in Iowa.
It's not just another business where you can pay people low wages and then shut down your enterprises in communities where it means so much to the kids and the families.
Senator Sanders speaking there in Burlington, Iowa, home to the minor league Burlington Bees. Mike Pesca is Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
So it doesn't seem like a smart PR move for Major League Baseball to go after minor league teams. What's going on?
It wasn't a smart PR move. They didn't want it to come out, though it has been widely reported. But of course, if you're going to engage in negotiations and one of your negotiating partners or one of the sides is both A, extremely distressed, and B, accurately assesses that the public will be on their side, it's going to leak. And we should say that Bernie Sanders, I mean, everything he was saying there is consistent with his worldview. But let's also remember, he was there in Burlington, Iowa. Back in Burlington, Vermont, there is a team called the Lake Monsters. So he has a local minor league team. This is not just him running for president. This is him actually representing his constituency. And if you look at the politics of this, there is an enormous Republican, Democrat, bipartisan uniting to save minor league teams, because there are people from small communities or places with minor league teams who are really worried that their minor league baseball teams are going to go away.
You know, the Lake Monster that they're talking about in Burlington, Vermont is Champ in Lake Champlain. That I know. Little piece of trivia. Okay, Mike, tell me about the business of minor league baseball. They don't make a lot of money. The ball players don't. And they don't have a union.
No, the ball players, they can make as little at the very low levels, you know, $1,000 a month. their Major League Baseball does own outright. The Major League Baseball teams do own a couple of minor league teams, like the Gwinnett Braves and the Tampa Bay Yankees. But mostly, the minor league affiliates are just that, affiliates, and they're owned by owners. They're owned by individual owners. At the upper reaches, these are thriving businesses, big businesses, really. But the further down you go, the more it becomes, you know, mom and pop, and maybe you draw 800 to a game, and maybe you have a champ as your mascot. And what Major League Baseball is saying is there's redundancy. There's so many more players. We draft more players than we need. We stock them in the minor leagues more than we need. And if we're going to think of this as a farm system, as if these are just, you know, an agricultural product, they're looking to cull the herd. From their perspective, it's monetarily logical, but of course, it's not just an agricultural product. These are teams with important connections to communities, and it is, as the kids say, a bad look for Major League Baseball, which hands out, I mean, the Yankees just gave Gerrit Cole an unbelievably large contract to make him, you know, essentially a quarter of a billionaire, and they can't, you know, support the Lake Monsters among them.
We have really taken this Lake Monster thing a long way in this interview. Mike, just a few seconds left. You got good holiday plans coming up?
Oh, yeah, I definitely do. I'd like to watch some basketball and maybe some Lake Monster baseball. I'm also going to New Orleans, going to catch the Pelicans. They just snapped the 13-game losing streak. Huzzah.
Mike Pesca here, now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, Merry Christmas. Thanks so
you
much
too.
For joining us. Happy
you
holidays.
Too.
We hear and heed the warnings every year around this time. Beware of porch pirates, especially today, which is the busiest day for receiving and returning packages. According to analysis by the New York Times, nearly 2 million packages are stolen or go missing every day across the country. In Denver, where the police department has been tracking package theft since 2015, there's been a significant uptick in porch pirates, which is why Frolic Brewing Company, just north of Denver, started allowing neighbors to send their packages there, where there is always someone waiting to accept them. Owner Chris Meiser says it's worth it.
Those working moms, those working dads that are sending their gift for either their kids or their significant other, they just want to make sure it's a happy season.
With as many as 20 packages delivered each day, Chris and his staff are going to be busy. But let's say you don't have a friendly local pub offering to get those packages for you. Well, we're joined now by Denver Police Officer Bob Anderson for some tips on how we might protect ourselves from porch pirates. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks. I appreciate you having me.
Officer Anderson, since 2015, you've seen a 68% increase in reported incidents of package thefts in Denver. This is in part, you say, because of the rise of online shopping. But what's going on? Is there a trend you're seeing where these doorstep thefts are happening?
No, we do. We definitely do see clusters, especially around the holidays. And we do get certain neighborhoods where these porch pirates will go in and they'll make several of them in a neighborhood, because my sense is that they see these delivery trucks coming into these neighborhoods and they know there's packages being dropped off.
Last year, we spoke with a Jersey City mayor who teamed up with Amazon to put GPS trackers inside of empty Amazon boxes. Mm-hmm. That's obviously a very big undertaking, but every city is combating this. What are you all doing at the Denver Police Department to address all of this?
First and foremost is awareness. We love that people can get things to their home, but if you know that you're not going to be home, think about your other options, because you don't even want to leave it on your porch for a few minutes. You know, can you get packages delivered to your workplace if you're lucky enough that your workplace allows that? Take advantage of that if you can do that. You know, and then you can, you know, when you order items from these companies, they give you options. You know, a lot of the companies have storage lockers that they have at retail establishments. You can have them shipped there and they'll give you a code. You can go put a code in and pick your item up. Some companies, you can have special locks delivered where they are allowed access into a certain door to leave your packages. Things to think about. If you are going to get them at your home, we do encourage, we're big fans of doorbell cameras. Those are fantastic.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about that. I wondered how those work. Yeah,
they're fantastic. You can do several types of settings on them, whether somebody actually presses the button on them, Or they can be motion sensors, and they'll send you an alert right to your phone. So you can say, hey, my package just came. Maybe I can call my neighbor since I'm not home, and my neighbor can walk over there and pick it up for me. Yeah. So, yeah, we're big fans of those. And if unfortunately your packages do become stolen, you might have valuable footage that the police can use in investigating that. If you live in a place where you get along and you know your neighbors very well, use your neighbors, you know, talk to each other. We encourage that, you know, have your neighbors come pick it up or have it delivered to your neighbor's place if they're going to be home. You know, we want neighbors talking to each other and keeping an eye out for each other. So they can,
we just have to get back to how we used to live, right? Say hi to your neighbor, get to know them.
Yeah, everything's, you know, digital these days, but there is something to be said for face-to-face contact. So it actually still works.
I can imagine, though, this has got to be taxing on your department. All of these tips that you're giving us are ways that we can actually be empowered to stop this from happening.
Right.
What happens when someone calls you guys? I'm sure you get a lot of calls at this time of year saying my packages have been stolen.
We do get a lot of calls, and we want those calls because I'll tell you why. Typically, the person that is stealing packages from people's homes are not just stopping at one home and taking a package. They're going up and down the streets, and this is a job for them. They're stealing multiple packages. You're not bothering us by calling. We want those calls. We want to know where these people are so we can get police officers out there right away. And also for our follow-up investigations, you know, we might have good surveillance video. Maybe somebody got a plate number. We have descriptions. Typically, when we find these people, they're responsible for multiple thefts. So that's why we want those calls.
Great tips. The one that's most resonant for me, get to know your neighbors. Say, hey,
yes.
My name is, yes. And I live right there, and can you watch out for my home and packages?
We encourage people, instead of driving home and just, you know, pulling into your garage and closing the garage door, it's good to know your neighbors. We are very community driven. We want people to know each other, look out for each other, and we want to be part of that as well. And if we can help in making that happen, we're available for that.
That's Denver Police Officer Bob Anderson. Thank you so much for your time and these tips.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I just want everybody to have a safe and happy holiday season and year-round as well. So we don't want those packages getting taken.
Thank you so much.
Thank you as well.
And now to the ongoing dispute between the companies that send you those packages. Earlier this week, FedEx reported lower second quarter earnings and shares dropped 10%. Among other things, the company blamed the loss of business to Amazon. The relationship between these two companies has been a rocky one, to say the least. Earlier this year, FedEx ended its ground delivery and express U.S. shipping contracts with Amazon. And this week, Amazon temporarily banned third-party sellers from using FedEx's ground and home delivery services for Prime orders. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of the Public Radio's Full Disclosure. And Robin, independent businesses that sell on Amazon make up nearly 60% of Amazon's total merchandise sales. What was the reason Amazon gave as to why they're banning them from using FedEx?
Yeah, Amazon said it made the decision owing to FedEx's, quote, poor delivery performance, that it wanted to make sure its Amazon shopping customers, you know, specifically Amazon Prime, would get their packages in time for Christmas, for Hanukkah. But you dig a bit deeper, Tanya, and this Amazon v. FedEx thing, it's been brewing for a while.
Yeah.
Amazon's building out its own delivery network, whether you're talking about air, ground, warehouses, last mile. This fall, just a few months ago, FedEx finally conceded that, yes, Amazon is a logistics competitor, and it's been denying that the company even posed a threat.
This will really impact Amazon sellers the most, though. How will they work around this to keep business running during this busy holiday season?
Well, there's always UPS. If you dare take a chance, you want to brave the USPS. And in addition, now Amazon has rolled out the Delivery Service Partners program, which is incenting mom and pops to join local delivery networks and transport packages from warehouses to the buyers. Mm-hmm. So FedEx and others are just going to have to start courting a bunch of different people. I wonder if the gig economy bleeds into this somehow. Of course, the third-party sellers themselves on Amazon, they've always had this love-fear-hate relationship with the platform. I mean, one minute it's making you a lot of money, the next minute you might be out of favor.
Yeah. FedEx's CFO said the company's earnings will improve in 2021 when its investments in the expansion of its delivery service starts to pay off. But Amazon, as you mentioned, is also ramping up its own delivery business. How well can FedEx really compete with a giant like Amazon?
You're now talking about this paradigm, especially in the Amazon Prime years, and everybody offering some modicum of free shipping, where it's now 7 days a week. You can't just be a Monday to Friday and maybe right. Saturday with an asterisk business. There's free shipping across lines of business. So in addition to that Amazon Delivery Service Partners program, I just think FedEx is going to have to look at its business, about how much of it is done via truck, how much it can truly guarantee the 2 day or less thing. Right. You know, these guys were frenemies beforehand, but now you're looking at a rival when the industry standard is 2 days or less and Amazon is building out airports and trucks. Mm-hmm. Are they your friend? Are they your enemy?
Yeah. I mean, what does this increasing competition between these companies actually mean for the future of shipping and delivery overall? You mentioned UPS. There are some other ones. But is this going to really change the landscape altogether?
I do believe it's a game changer. Look at everything Amazon has touched in the past 5, 10, 15, 20 years. It's the everything company. What started off as a book or CD in your mailbox, it's now an Amazon-branded van in your driveway on a Sunday. I mean, imagine how much that must terrify a retail CEO. And if you believe the technology, there's going to be an Amazon drone buzzing over your chimney soon enough. And Tanya, I wouldn't put it past Amazon to maybe make a run at UPS or something. I don't know if in this antitrust environment with the Trump White House not loving Jeff Bezos and Amazon, if it's possible. But increasingly, it looks like it's its manifest destiny to become a true competitor to the likes of FedEx and the USPS.
Yeah, that's Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you for this update.
My pleasure.
The future of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, is once again uncertain today after a federal appeals court struck down a key portion of the law yesterday. That key portion is the individual mandate, which requires that people have health insurance or pay a penalty. The court decided to send the case back to a lower court to determine if the rest of the Affordable Care Act can exist without that mandate. If the ACA is struck down, some 20 million people would lose their health coverage, and 50 million people could be denied coverage because they have pre-existing conditions. Joining us now is Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Jeremy.
Okay, so I'm going to just ask you, because this gets very complicated very quickly, but what does this ruling mean?
Well, this ruling means basically what you said at the very top, that the Affordable Care Act remains in limbo. We don't know what's going to happen to it. We don't actually even know what the next step is going to be in the legal proceedings. There are a couple of possibilities, but basically sort of politically, the Affordable Care Act might be allowed to stand, or it might be struck down in part, or it might be struck down in full. We just don't know yet.
Well, and let's remind people about the individual mandate, because the individual mandate was a key part of Obamacare that said that you have to have health insurance, otherwise you have to pay a tax penalty. But then when the Trump administration came in, they reduced that penalty to zero, but the mandate is still there. So this court says that makes it unconstitutional?
That's right. And it wasn't the Trump administration. It was Congress. Congress tried to repeal the Affordable Care Act in 2017, and they rather famously didn't have the votes when John McCain wouldn't join them. So in the tax bill that they did in December of that year, they reduced the penalty to zero. It was part of the tax bill. And a bunch of Republican attorneys general said, aha, if there's no more penalty, then it's no longer a tax. And if it's no longer a tax, then it's unconstitutional. That was their argument. And they found a lower court judge in Texas who agreed with them. And he said that not only is the mandate now unconstitutional, the rest of the law has to fall with it. The appeals court said, we agree that the mandate without the actual tax amount is no longer constitutional, but we're going to send it back to the lower court to take another look at how much of the rest of the law really requires the mandate to stand. Now, the actual irony of all this is that the penalty's been gone for almost a year now. It disappeared on January 1st of 2019. The law's been functioning just fine without it. So the argument that penalty is necessary to make the law function is demonstrably not the case.
That people are still buying health insurance even without a penalty, saying, you know, that is held over them, saying, if you don't buy it, you're going to have to pay this penalty.
That's right. It turns out, and this is not necessarily what Congress thought at the time, but it turns out that the subsidies, that helping people afford their insurance, is a bigger boost to people buying insurance than the threat of a fine that in the end wasn't all that big anyway. So now that the subsidies are there, and in some cases the subsidies have been made larger, people are happy to buy health insurance. Now, it's true that the number of people buying insurance on the marketplaces is down a little bit, and part of that is due to the better economy. People have other options for insurance, and the Trump administration's trying not to do any outreach. But there's still robust enough enrollment that the law is not in any threat of sort of imploding, which is what the concern was if there was no penalty.
So, Julie, does this put Republicans in a tough spot politically because they had campaigned for getting rid of the Affordable Care Act? But in the last election, they came out and said they like the pre-existing conditions part of it that protects people with pre-existing conditions and makes sure that they can get coverage. We haven't heard very much about it since the 2018 election. I mean, what are they going to say now? Are they going to say they hope that this lower court just strikes down the whole law or not?
Well, no, I think probably what they deep down hoped was that the appeals court would overrule the lower court and say, yeah, everything is fine. I mean, they don't like the law, but what they would like even less would be for the law to go away because they don't have a replacement that they can agree on. And there are a lot of popular things in the law. And one of the big ironies from the big fight in 2017 is that the law, which had been sort of bumping along somewhat popular but not very, now has much stronger support among the public. So if the law went away, the Republicans would be kind of on the wrong side of that, except for, you know, their very small base. So the idea this could go directly to the Supreme Court, it could still be decided this year, that will sort of challenge both Democrats and Republicans in some ways. It's a big game of chess right now.
Has the Supreme Court, though, with its new makeup, changed the dynamic on this issue? Because it was John Roberts who said Obamacare is constitutional with this mandate.
That's right. The assumption is that Roberts would rule with the four liberals if it went to the Supreme Court now. But of course, you don't know that for sure. That's why this is all about rolling the dice.
Interesting. So what's next? How long is this going to take?
If it goes back to the lower court, it could literally take years. If it goes to the Supreme Court, it could be this year or it could be next year. But, you know, we're going to have to live with the uncertainty for a while longer.
All right. Well, that means we'll be able to keep coming back and talking to you about what's going on with the Affordable Care Act. Julie,
you
Robner,
know where to find me.
We do. Julie Robner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.